This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us today. In his 18 years writing the Minimalist column for the New York Times, Mark Bittman has shaped the way we think about food and cooking. In September, the preeminent food writer announced his retirement from his writing post at the Times. We were joined by Bittman in the studio last year when he discussed his views on food, the food industry, and his entree into writing about the culinary world. Let's take a listen.
Do you have a book about how to clean up after dinner fast?
Well, you know, cleaning, I think, also, what a friend of mine used to say, cleanliness is a continuous process. You know, it just goes on and on.
But do you suggest sort of like cooking, which is sort of cleaning, cooking, prepping all at the same
time? Well, to the extent you can. Sometimes it gets out of control, right? I mean, we don't want to put a gloss on anything here. There is work to be done in the kitchen. Right. It's not all fun and games. It just happens to be worthwhile work, and it's work that's more worthwhile than a lot of other things that we do. So, and often quite enjoyable, and you get to eat.
You were actually complaining about all the focus on kale these days, as if this is this brand new vegetable that has just been discovered. But we were also talking briefly about pumpkins.
Yeah, kale's over.
Forget it with kale.
No one's talking about it. We had a kale shortage, which was the most laughable thing imaginable. I think that pumpkin is the new kale. And God knows what's going to happen. In the spring, it's going to be leeks, or it's going to be ramps, or it's going to be fiddlehead ferns or something. It's now become that we will fetishize an ingredient every season. And I do think you're going to – I mean, the pumpkin thing started with these ridiculous pumpkin lattes. Yeah, well, but it's – you know, pumpkin spice is the flavor of the month, and pumpkin is – that you'll see. You'll see. Mark my words. This I'm quite certain about. Although you could also ignore the whole thing and leave just
Is that what you do?
Fine.
I mean, sort of like cupcakes, right?
I don't ignore it. It's impossible to ignore. But I think, you know, we have this world of food out there with God knows how many thousands of actual ingredients. So to start obsessing about one is a little nutty. But, you know, that's we're Americans. We do things in a very weird way.
What do you think we have? And I don't mean to sound so psychological here, but sort of a eating disordered view of eating.
We are saints and sinners. We see things
food,
black and
food.
White. Yeah, I mean, we do not have sound traditions, and I think it's partly because we are so heterogeneous. There is no archetypical American. I mean, that's in other countries that's happening also, but there has never been, you know, an archetypical, well, we could argue that, but certainly since the beginning of the 20th century, America has been overwhelmed by the numbers of different kinds of people and therefore cuisines here, and we don't have a cuisine. Right. If you go to Italy, it's true that it changes every 30 miles, but you know you're eating Italian food. And same in Japan, and same in Thailand, and same in Mexico, many, many other countries. Here, I guess you only know you're eating American food because it's bad.
Well, I was also thinking just how, you know, we do the good food, the bad food. Half the country is on a diet. You know, we have gigantic portions. I mean, you look at the size of a plate. And then there's the CSAs and the vegans. Yeah. And it's an interesting, very complex relationship, it seems, with food.
Well, it is. And hopefully it's becoming more clear. I think many people are beginning to realize. I think at this point, if you said in any poll, if you said, do you understand what constitutes a decent diet? Most people, the majority of people, would know the answers to that. Do you eat a decent diet? And, you know, a tiny minority does. Everybody else is dissembling, to put a nice word.
Or disassembling, as I think President Bush once said, yes.
Yeah.
But I mean, there are all these temptations, right? There are pretzels just down the hall here.
The triumph of the food corporations is that they have marketed value-added food, which means food that's been turned into something that vaguely resembles food but isn't really food and is often poison, would qualify as poison. They have marketed that to the detriment of real food. So this is why, you know, this is why we have an obesity crisis. This is why diabetes rates are skyrocketing or have skyrocketed. This is why we have a problem. It's not because we're stupid. It's not because there isn't real food around, because there is real food around. It's because at every turn there's pretzels down the hall. There's Cinnabons in every airport. There's, what's the new pretzel thing in airports?
Oh,
Annie's or
something.
Oh,
Annie's, yeah.
And there's a, you know, you can rely on there being a McDonald's and a Burger King and a this and a that every time you leave your house. There is better fast food coming down the pike. There are better things, choices available out there. But at the end of the day, and the reason I'm such a strong advocate for cooking is that at the end of the day, if you take real ingredients, which I think we know what they are, you take real food and you combine it using heat or scissors or knives or whatever you want to use to combine it, you wind up with stuff that's healthy. You are not going to poison yourself. But if you go into the supermarket or the fast casual restaurant or the fast food restaurant and you buy the stuff that the big food companies want you to buy, you are more than likely going to be eating things that are passing for food. They're not real food, and they can make you sick.
Well, we're talking about fat and salt and sugar. And I mean, now they at least put the calories next to a lot of this food, but it is shocking to see how many, you know, a fish sandwich is like 1,000 calories.
Well, calorie counts are falling, and they're falling because restaurants are going to be, you know, it's a little known clause in the Affordable Care Act that said fast food restaurants have to post calorie counts, and that's starting to kick in. And those calorie counts are going to fall because people are going to say, I'm not going to eat a 1,200 calorie hamburger. I mean, come on. So there's progress. It's slow. To the extent that we can understand these things ourselves and make personal choices, that's very powerful. But to the extent that we can get government to be on our side instead of on Pepsi's side, that's even more powerful. Mm.
In fact, you say the FDA, USDA, I mean, slow to respond, perhaps.
Grudgingly, slowly being hauled into the 21st century. I mean, the FDA does, both FDA and USDA do make good decisions from time to time, but not as often as they make bad ones. And usually they make them in a, like I said, begrudging and ill-conceived manner. I mean, I could get specific, but maybe it's not that interesting.
So how and where and when did you discover the great joys of cooking?
I started cooking more or less out of self-defense. I lived in New York. I grew up in New York. I was exposed to a lot of great food. And then I went to school in Massachusetts, which at the time, 1967, was probably the most abysmal place in the United States to eat. It's probably not true. But it was bad. There was nothing. I wasn't even in Boston. So by my first year, I pretty much subsisted on vanilla ice cream, Coke, and cheeseburgers, fries, I suppose. My second year, I got a kitchen and I started to cook. Following year, I moved back to New York, wound up moving in with three women, one of whom I later married, one of whom lives in Philly, and they cooked. They were really good cooks, and I got into it, and I just never stopped. Oh. I never stopped cooking after I was 20. I studied it, and then I started writing about it, and after that, there was this, no pun intended, feedback loop of I had to write about it, so I had to cook more. I was cooking more, so my writing got better, and so on. I was a writer before. I mean, I started cooking and writing more or less simultaneously. And of course, I started writing when I was in grade school, so I suppose I started writing first. But I considered myself a writer, but I was a cook. And then when I started writing about food, it worked. So as you and I were discussing before we came on air, you don't always choose your career path. This is mine. I am a writer who writes about food.
Interesting, you were in the Boston area around 1967, because that was sort of in Philadelphia anyway, the beginnings of this restaurant, as we call it, renaissance here in the city that I'm happy to say still continues. But it was an interesting time. You and I are probably about the same age. An interesting time when people, you know, sort of discovered food, a different kind of food.
Yeah, I think, you know, we grew up in the beginnings of the era of convenience food. And yeah, I think the war didn't have the impact on the United States that it had on Europe, for sure. But there was some... I think a lot of the art of cooking had been forgotten, and maybe it started to revive with people our age a little bit. Yeah.
You wrote about something that you did to lose some weight, which was this VB6, Vegan Before Six. Do you still live, eat that way?
I do.
Think that way?
I have to describe it first. It is a diet or a lifestyle change, whatever you want to call it. I never quite know, because diet can mean how you live. It doesn't necessarily mean lose 21 pounds in 21 days, but it is a method of eating, which I do, which is basically eat unprocessed plants, legumes, whole grains, fruits, vegetables, nuts and seeds, etc., from the time I wake up till dinner time. And it's a discipline. And then at dinner, I do whatever the hell I want to do. So it's a kind of part-time, super strict, seems to be lifetime diet that I do, which I'm on year 8 of this. So it's not as if it's going away. So anything that gets you to eat more plants, which is something we're going to all have to do, anything that does that is beneficial. And this is a strategy for that.
What do you think about eating meat? I mean, as you said, vegan before 6.
Well, but I mean, I think we eat way too – we raise too much, we eat too much, and the methods we use to raise it are disgusting. So if we fixed the way that we produce meat, we'd have to eat less of it. And if we ate less of it, we'd probably produce less of it. So there's a bit of a circle there. It would be beneficial for land and animals and ourselves if we ate 10% of the meat that we eat now. Mm-hmm. But if we ate 10% less of the meat we ate now, it would be a big deal.
You also say don't forget the food workers. I mean, we care about food, you know, the animals that go through the slaughterhouse. You've written, don't forget the people that work there.
I do think that 5 years ago, there was more talk about animal welfare than there was about human welfare. I think the fact that people who labor in the food world are now getting their attention. And a lot of the $15 an hour minimum wage movement started in the food world. So I think that's a great sign of progress, actually.
Is there a food that you think of for yourself as a comfort food? When things, you know, you're just not feeling.
What did I say? I have pasta and salad or pasta and fish or fish and salad or fish and pasta. Yeah, sort of like that. No, but I mean, it's. I open the refrigerator. You know, I stop on the way home. If I'm cooking, I buy something. I open the refrigerator. I see what's in there. I cook it. I mean, it's all comforting to me. If I get home at 11:30 at night and I still need to eat something, it's either pasta or eggs. But that's the way it is.
Do you feel like you have a good job?
Yeah, I feel like I have
mean,
a
even
good
if
life.
It wasn't the one that you planned.
Yeah, I feel like I have a good life.
That was my 2014 interview with Mark Bittman. He recently announced his retirement from his job writing the Minimalist column for the New York Times. You're listening to Radio Times in Review, and when we get back from our break, we'll hear from actor Dennis Quaid, whose new show, The Art of More, was made available yesterday on Crackle. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The so-called golden age of television has long been underway. One of the hallmarks of our recent television boom has been marquee talents turning away from the big screen and taking roles in long-form serials. Dennis Quaid has recently made that transition. He's the star and executive producer of the new drama, The Art of More. It's the first hour-long drama from the streaming service Crackle and was made available just yesterday. The show portrays the complexities of the million-dollar auction house world. Quaid plays a loudmouth real estate mogul, which he admittedly based on Donald Trump. He joined us in the studio in 2008 to discuss his life, his career, and some of his most famous roles, including his take on the controversial rock and roll legend Jerry Lee Lewis. Let's take a listen.
You are a very good golfer, yes?
That's,
could you say that?
That's debatable. I mean, you mean before my twins or?
Well, I realize that the parenthood and work can
sends
intrude
the handicap up. Yeah,
but for a while, I mean, you were. I mean, you're a good golfer, right?
I really enjoy
and you love the
game.
Game.
Yeah, that's my great escape.
How so?
Well, it's just I can get out on a golf course and be there with my friends or be there be by myself and really, you know, the rest of the world, all that the world kind of slithers back and there's just the moment and just being outside.
Have you played your whole life, or is this something?
No,
you came
I came to it late in life, actually. I was. It was actually, I had a problem with cocaine, actually,
yes,
in my 20s and 30s. And actually, the day I got out of rehab, I started playing golf.
Really?
So it was, yeah, it went from one obsession to the next.
But this is a little more healthy, I think, anyway.
I think.
But was it a good, then, antidote to how you felt when you were doing drugs?
Yes, it was, because everything comes up. Golf makes you really get to know yourself, and you really get to know someone else, too, as well. It challenges you. You're playing yourself, basically.
Yes. A kind of therapy?
Right.
I mean, was it kind of a post-rehab therapy for you?
Well, I guess, yeah, looking back, it probably was. But I guess I'm an obsessive personality to begin with. When I focus on something that I like to do, I do it.
And you did a lot of drugs in your 20s
and 30s? In my 20s and 30s. I was, you know, part of the, you know, the late 60s and, and 70s, you know, scene. And, you know, it was a time in my life and, you know, that I went through. And some ways I'm glad for my experiences because it's, you know, I am what I am today. And I'm really glad I lived through it. A lot of people I know didn't survive it.
Were you close to not surviving? I mean,
I was lucky. I had one of those white light experiences, really, where I saw myself losing everything and was able to get some help before that occurred.
Wow. Was it, and not to dwell on your drug problem, but it just was an incremental problem that you had?
You know, back, you know, in those times, it was a time of experimentation. We were all trying to expand our minds and everything with, you know,
just cocaine
in the
or
60s. That in the 60s, and then that became the party in the 70s, which, you know, really, I think the big wake up call for everybody was John Belushi. In the early 80s.
Was that a wake-up call for you?
Yes, it was, which I ignored pretty much at the time, you know, and made a note and ignored. Everybody has their own path and way, and, I was lucky.
You were lucky. I mean, you feel that way looking back?
Yeah, I feel lucky in life to begin with.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you miss it, though?
Miss it? No, not at all, in fact. It's one of those, because I know it's around, you know, a lot, but it was really, in the end, I look back at it, cocaine, when someone's addicted to cocaine, it's like being one of those lab rats, basically. You're mindlessly
searching the maze.
Searching it out, you know, and it just takes over your life in a way that... needless and really very narrow and confining.
Well, you did grow up in Houston, Texas.
Right.
Were you a movie buff as a kid? Was there like the local movie theater that you and your brother would go to?
Right from the very beginning. Our dad was a frustrated actor.
Was he?
But actually, I come from a family of showbiz people, you might say. I mean, my great-grandfather was in vaudeville. Okay. My cousin happens to be Gene Autry. So we, you know, hear those stories. And my dad really turned us on into movies and into actors. I would go to the movies when I was a kid, and I would come out feeling like either Jimmy Stewart or John Wayne or especially Steve McQueen. Everybody wanted to be Steve McQueen.
Well, The Great Escape, isn't that one of your favorite movies?
Yeah, my favorite movies, that and Bullet. And so it's just gravitated towards that and dabbled in it in a playful way in high school, but there was one particular teacher when I got to the University of Houston, Cecil Pickett, who was taught acting as a craft, and within a week of being in his class, yeah, I had a great gift from him because I knew what I wanted at 19. I knew what I wanted to do with my life, and that's it. I think that's a really great gift to have
it
at
sure
that
is.
Age.
What did he tell you, or what did you learn from him that made that so clear?
Just the way he talked about acting, you know, as I said, he taught it as a craft, and it made it something real to me, and really turned me on to this passion, which I still carry, which is what makes people tick.
Yeah.
And I'm really interested in that, and human nature, and in all its contradictions and ambiguities, and about what makes character. And I still carry that with me today. In fact, I'm having more fun with it now than I did in my 20s, to tell you the truth.
Is that just because you've done so much of it, or you're just a more mature, older person that understands human nature a little bit better?
Well, maybe partly, but I think of now, you know, I'm in my 50s, and I'm really not trying to make it or get the first job, and I'm not trying to prove anything to myself or to anyone else or be something, you know, that I'm told that I'm supposed to be. Mm-hmm. I'm just enjoying acting and doing that, just like I did when I was back in his class.
That's nice. And we should add that your brother, Randy Quaid, is also an actor.
Great actor. One of my favorite actors.
He's a bit older than you, a couple years older than you?
A couple of years, yeah.
So did you sort of follow him in a way? Or?
Yeah, I guess I did. I followed, he was out in L.A. before I was, and it was great because, you know, he was really kind of forged the path out there.
I was looking at Breaking Away, one of your first films. That was, what, I think 1979? Was that 30 years ago, mm-hmm. something like that? You play the sort of towny part of this bike team. What was that like for you to – I don't know how old you were at the time.
I was 24.
Yeah. Was that sort of your first big
– That was – yeah, I'd done about, I think, three other films and a couple of like television shows like Beretta.
Yeah.
Stuff like
that. That's
before,
okay.
Before that. Yeah, it was actually I look back on that with fond memories, but Breaking Away came along, and it was for me it was a great break for me and a great opportunity. It made it a lot easier for me to get jobs after that. And the film, I love that movie. Peter Yates, who directed it,
really holds up.
And Steve Tessage, who wrote it, amazing people.
You were very thin in that movie.
Well, I was 24. I was a skinny kid.
Yeah, I mean, you could see your ribs. I just noticed that, which actually reminded me of the Doc Holliday in Wyatt Earp. You were really
well. I was skinny
thin.
In that. I lost 44 pounds for that role, just because I wanted to get in Doc's head. I mean, you know, I don't know if I could do that again, to tell you the truth. But
to lose 44 pounds,
I was 138 from like 182, which I am right now, and it changes your brain, really, to lose that weight and to hold that weight for 5 months, which is how long the movie took to shoot.
Was it your idea just to be so thin? And he's ill, you know.
Well, yeah, Doc Holliday, a legendary figure of the West, and he was, you know, tuberculosis, and he was a very thin guy, you know, emaciated, and but it's part of what made him such a great gunfighter at the time, because he didn't care about dying. He was able to actually be calm and stand there and slowly draw and fire where everybody else was just blazing away and they'd miss. And it made him mean.
And it made him mean. Was that a fun character
but
to
I
play?
Yeah, I love Doc. I really did. I love that character.
And did you have fun gaining all that weight back then? Or do you have to be careful?
Yeah, well, I did it. I lost the weight with a nutritionist, and, you know, and a doctor, because you really have to watch it. But coming back, I think my first meal was a banana cream pie and Mexican food. So.
Hope your stomach could stand that, right?
<that's>, yeah.
Well, I'd love to talk about The Big Easy. We actually have a clip from that, but this is another one of the films that that you were in. You play this detective. And it also stars Ellen Barkin, who plays district attorney. How'd you get that part?
that part came to me. It was called Nothing But the Truth. The script was. It took place in Chicago. And it was basically the same storyline, but Jim, the director, I went in to meet with him, and he said the first thing out of his mouth was, I wanted to change it to New Orleans. And I growing up in Houston, I've been in New Orleans a couple of times. I loved New Orleans, and that was just – I was in right from the very beginning. And he really included me in the process, and we wound up, you know, together rewriting as we went along. It was really a fantastic time, sort of spontaneous time making that film. And I drove around with the homicide cops in New Orleans for a month and a half before we started making the film, which is an eye opener to, you know, a side of life that I'd never seen before. And Ellen was fantastic, an incredible actress, and the movie I think really captured the feel of New Orleans.
Well, let's play a scene, and this is you and the Ellen Barkin character. She's the district attorney sitting in a bar and talking together.
My grandpapa on my mama's side, now he was the real Cajun, now born and deaded on the Bayou Teche.
I thought you came from a family of Irish cops.
No, that was on my daddy's side. He was the first one to become a cop.
Followed by three brothers, one son, and four nephews.
Well, my cousin Terry joined the fire department. He's the black sheep of the family.
You were the youngest detective in the history of the NOPD to ever make lieutenant.
Well, I had an in the department, sugar.
Careful who you say that to.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You bust cops for a living.
I'm not embarrassed to put bad cops behind bars.
And that's a scene from The Big Easy. There's such chemistry between the two of you. I mean, you can even hear that even without watching it.
Laissez le bon temps rouler.
And did you work hard on that accent? I mean, it's a very specific New
Orleans
Cajun. It's
very specific because there is it's really a cross between like a Cajun accent, which is Southwest Louisiana, and a New Orleans yat, which is almost sort of a Brooklynese type of you know, thing. And then you try to put them together, and I actually did meet five people in New Orleans.
Is that right?
Yeah, who had, that was
their unique accent.
Yeah, the unique accent, right. You know, I get some people say, "Oh, that was a great accent." And some people from New Orleans, you know, this is like, you know, you missed it so far. But that was what it was.
Let me just segue from that to another film that you did, and this was about Jerry Lee Lewis, the rockabilly, controversial rockabilly star. And you are a musician; you have a band. How important was it, do you think, for you, just because you are a musician, that you could sort of understand his music and his whole sort of style of living and playing
with the killer?
Yeah, with the killer.
Yeah, well, we shot that in Memphis, and incredible time. That was we got to rehearse every night in the Old Sun Studios.
Wow,
you know, there when Sam Phillips was around, and I got to rehearse with Jerry Lee's old band from back then, and I saw Jerry Lee Lewis every day.
He was there on the set every day, right?
For better or worse, he was there every day, right over my shoulder. So, you're doing it wrong, son. whatever. But an incredible person. I mean, you know, just a giant of an icon. We were around in the movie. We were in the recording studio a lot, and he could sit at the piano for 12 hours and not get up, even for a bathroom break. Amazing. And just play and play and play.
Is there something in particular that you look for when you're reading a script or someone offers you a part? I mean, obviously you want something that's well-written, interesting characters. As you said, you like exploring this notion of character. But is there anything in particular that you look for?
I'm really looking for a good story. I love great stories. And I don't know if I forget if I've said this before, but when I read a script, it's the only time I get to be an audience member with a first-time experience of that. And so I'm looking for a really good story, or I'm looking for five good belly laughs.
That helps,
yeah,
right?
That you know, if it's a comedy or you know something there, or to feel something. That's really my criteria for it. And then after that, it's about the filmmaker, because it is a director's medium. And who else is going to be doing it?
Sure. And wanting to feel comfortable
mm-hmm. safe in the hands of a director.
Mm-hmm. I like strong directors. Mm-hmm. I really do. I like to be directed because when I work, I like to try out all kinds of different things, a lot of them which are, you know, completely wrong.
but I want to be able to be wrong.
And there's a lot of film and a lot of takes. And so I trust a director right. who is the storyteller to take what he wants and shape what he wants.
I do have a question for you about just living in the kind of fishbowl. I mean, I think anyone that works in Hollywood lives in a kind of a fishbowl. You've had ups and downs in your career, marriages, divorces. Do you ever get used to that? I mean, is there a way to defend against all that sort of outside gossipy discussions about your life?
I think that's part of the territory that comes of this. You know, certainly, you know, the fame and celebrity is not why I got into doing what I do. I got it because of acting, but that comes with the territory, and you just accept that part of your life.
If it happens,
oh, certainly I get mad, of course, but at times. You can't hold on to that. You know, and the fact is that I have a very vibrant private life, and
you're smiling when you're saying that.
Yeah,
I mean, good.
But,
I'm glad.
You know, I really enjoy my life. I feel, because the overwhelming truth is that's, you know, a part of things, but that's not what I think about. I just feel lucky to still be doing what I'm doing at the level that I'm doing it. And a lot of people I started out with, that they're not around anymore. Yeah. And I feel very grateful. I'm lucky to have the kind of job that I have.
We just heard my conversation with actor Dennis Quaid, whose new show, The Art of More, was made available yesterday on the online streaming service Crackle. This is Radio Times in Review. When we return from the short break, we'll hear from singer-songwriter Janice Ian. Stay tuned.
Come to my door, baby. Face is clean and shining black as night.
Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're listening to singer-songwriter Janice Ian's first big hit, Society's Child, a song she wrote at the age of 13. The song set off a firestorm because it was about an interracial relationship in a tumultuous time of shifting racial perspectives in the country. She joined us in the studio in 2008 when we talked about the fallout of Society's Child, her life in New Jersey and Philadelphia, and her most famous song, At 17, which became a number one hit 40 years ago. But first, let's listen to more of Society's Child.
Walk me down to school, baby. Everybody's acting different in the line. Until they turn and say, why don't you stick to your own kind? My teachers all laughed at smirking stares, cutting deep down in our affairs. Preachers of equality think they believe it, then why won't they just let us be?
You have talked about, and this song, which was your first hit song, a very controversial song, and this idea of this interracial couple who were romantic, and then, of course, the relationship doesn't work out. As you said, people spat at you.
Oh,
radio stations wouldn't play this song.
People were fired for playing it. Radio station in Atlanta was burned down. It's hard to imagine now, if you didn't live through the 60s, what a divisive period it was. I think I start the book off by saying that I was born into the crack that split America. And it felt very much like that at that time. Even when I was living here in Philly back in 68, 69, 70, it was still just very divided. It's funny because blacks and whites were less divided, I think. And yet, culturally, the older and the younger was so split.
Will you even describe performing, and I'm assuming you're a teenager, performing this song, and people are shouting at you, yelling epithets at you?
People actually bought tickets to the shows to boo me off the stage. Yeah, it was extraordinary. And I certainly wasn't prepared for that. But I like to say, you know, I wrote my first song at 12 and I was published at 13, made a record at 14, had a hit at 15, and by 17 I was a has-been. And that's pretty much it.
I mean, it's so interesting now at your age, looking back at the very beginning of your career. I mean, in hindsight, were you ready for all the things that happened to you then?
Oh, you know what? In hindsight, I don't think you're ever ready. I mean, if you become famous when you're 90, I don't think you're ready. Certainly, I wasn't ready for the kind of controversy that Society's Child engendered. I wasn't ready for people to be spitting at me in the street or any of that. You think that fame is going to change you, and it really doesn't. It changes everybody around you. And that gets really weird. You know, your parents start looking at you like you're from another planet, and friends, instead of giving you the usual birthday gifts, try and buy you expensive stuff. Everybody is worried that that you're not happy. You know, and it's not normal to have everybody around you worried that you're not happy. That's just weird.
Were you lonely then?
I think it's in the nature of being an artist to be lonely, or to be alone, maybe, to be an outlaw.
Well, interestingly, having read your book, I mean, there have been highs and lows in your life. I mean, you have been up in the pinnacle and down in the valley.
Down in the very depths, yeah. Down in the valley, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Well, I think that in part... I never meant to live such a soap opera life. I really did not.
I don't think anyone does.
No, and I didn't intend for there to be all that drama. I'd much rather have saved the drama for my work, which is where it really belongs. It's just somehow the nature of me that I live like that.
Yeah. Now, you grew up in South Jersey. In fact, grew up on a chicken farm.
I started out on a chicken farm. My dad was a farmer. My mom was a waitress. And then my dad went to college on the GI Bill and became a teacher. My mom wound up being a fundraiser, and we migrated from South Jersey all over New Jersey because the FBI were tracking us. My dad couldn't get tenure anywhere because of it as a teacher. So we moved every 2 years until we finally landed in New York when I was 14.
In fact, you have a song about that called God and the FBI, but you write about FBI people would knock on your door,
hang
neighbors.
Hang out at the mailbox, look at our mail, right. follow me to school. It's pretty, what a waste of taxpayers' resources, really.
Well, what was so suspicious about your family?
Apparently, my father had, quite literally, and it says so in his FBI file, he had gone to a meeting of chicken farmers and talked about the price of eggs in New Jersey back before I was born, and he was picked up on his way home. You know, it's J. Edgar Hoover. I mean, here's a guy who started keeping files on classmates when he was 7. Nowadays, we'd have him in therapy. He was a very strange man. Yeah. He was an extremely strange man, and the strange part is that he was in the right time and place to have that much power in our country. And it's very frightening when you think how close we came to being a totalitarian state through the efforts of just a few entrenched people.
So how do you think that affected you as a kid growing up? I mean, to be so watched by this government organization. Was this something your family joked about?
It certainly makes you uncomfortable dating.
I would think so. I mean, where you feel like nothing is safe, nothing is private. Right?
You feel like nothing is private, but I think that was, in a sense, a good preparation for today's world, because between Google Maps and everything else going on now, nothing is private. Right. I mean, my partner is an attorney, and she says, don't expect any privacy nowadays, you know, as those rights are eroded. Right. Outside of that, anybody can find you anywhere.
So this was a good lesson for you to learn as a little girl for today's world.
And I think it was very schizophrenic, too, for me. Less so for my kid brother, because he was much younger. But for me, certainly, having to watch what I said, having to be careful that people in the school system didn't know that we went to visit, say, the Rosenberg kids, or that we attended certain meetings. And what's weirdest about it is that my dad wasn't a communist. My mother wasn't a communist. They were far from it. They were resolute capitalists. I mean, I was raised to be the American dream.
And as you say, your father was unable to hold on to jobs because they would come and, I guess, raise questions about his loyalty, to the United States?
Or? Yeah, we didn't know that until he was in his 60s. We didn't understand that when he came up for tenure every 2 years in a school system, the FBI would send a couple of agents to talk to the principal and ask whether he had been seen consorting with known communists. And there went the tenure.
Right. I mean, just that question was enough.
Just that question was plenty.
Now, you began playing the piano. You were about,
two and a half.
2.5 years. Was that just sort of noodling with the keys?
No, apparently I was quite serious about it. I don't remember it. I remember putting it together that noise was coming from my dad and the piano in one blinding moment. And that was like, the only thing I can compare it to is I'd spent my time until then hovering, and then I landed on Earth. I mean, as crazy as that sounds.
Yeah.
And I apparently went to my dad and demanded that he teach me to make those noises. And he kind of laughed and said that I needed to learn to count and tell time in my ABCs. And apparently I went to my mom the next day and said, teach me. And the next day I went to my dad and said, okay, 1 through 10, ABCs, and now teach me.
So was this a musical family?
My dad was very musical. My mom was musical too, but she didn't play. Uh-huh. But my dad played, and that was his great passion.
So what was the music? What was the sort of soundtrack to your childhood?
Oh, gosh, it was everything. Classical music, because that's what my father played. Jazz, because that's what my mother loved. A lot of world music, people like, at the time, Miriam Makeba. A lot of music that wasn't heard in most households, I think. Just very open.
You also describe hearing, or maybe it was seeing Odetta on television. You were nine.
That changed my life.
Yes. And what was it about? I mean, she does have an extraordinary, resonant voice.
There was something about it. I remember because I was in another room and I heard this sound from the living room and I went running in yelling, who is that? Who is that? And my mother looked up from the TV and said, that's Odetta. And I looked and here was this, first, a black woman, and that was rare on TV. Second, a black woman with an afro. I'd never even seen that except in pictures of Africans. And third, she was wearing these amazing hoop earrings and beating the crap out of her guitar. I had never seen anybody do that. I was just totally entranced.
Wow.
And then we somehow got up the money to go to a show of hers in Princeton, I think, or Rutgers. And we sat up in the nosebleed section, and I spent an hour and a half just in awe. And the next day, I knew that's what I was going to do.
You lived in Philadelphia for a while. You were, what, about 18 years old?
I moved here when I was 17 and a half, and I left when I was, I think, 20 or almost 21. So I lived here for quite a while. Philadelphia informed my life.
How so?
Many ways. I came down here in part because I was seeing a therapist here after the shock of Society's Child, and I really got put back together in a lot of ways in Philly. I lived in the least desirable section of the city, which is now, of course, an area that I could never afford to live in.
Very she-she area.
Very she-she. It was the Rizzo years, so it was an interesting time to be living here. I grew up in Philadelphia. That's how I think of it. I learned to be a person.
I also heard, or I think I read in the paper, that you also felt like you learned to write in Philadelphia.
I did. I wasn't sure after Society's Child whether it had been a fluke, as everyone else thought, or whether I could ever be the kind of... I wanted to be a great writer. I wanted to be a writer like a Johnny Mercer was a writer, a George Gershwin. You know, those are pretty high standards. And
especially for someone who's 17 years old.
Yeah, and basically a cultural idiot, too, because I had never read anything. And I set about, as part of my becoming human again, I set about reading. My boyfriend at the time, Peter, who's still a good friend of mine, brought me books. And I learned to read poetry, and I read Ezra Pound and Rimbaud and all the things you do when you're a teenager. But I also read a lot of plays and things like that. And I set myself the task of writing a song a day for a couple of months, then two a week, and then one a week, and then one a month, and then finally to write when I felt like it. It took about 2 years, but it was great training.
And therapy helped you? I mean, obviously therapy helps a person put themselves back together, perhaps even understand themselves more. Did that make you a better writer, do you think?
I think that clarity makes you a better writer. Anything that helps you become clear, anything that helps you to understand yourself. And a writer's job is really not just to understand themselves, but the world around them. So anything that gets you from that horrible performer's self-obsessed, self-absorbed, narcissistic lifestyle and mental set and moves you into, oh my gosh, other people's lives are interesting too. Anything that can do that for you as a writer is good for you. That's what I think anyway. Writers write at their best to me when they're healthiest.
Right. You wrote a song, Jesse, out of Philadelphia, and I guess in
and Stars.
And Stars as well. That these were songs that sort of brought you back into the world of music, would you say?
Jesse and Stars convinced me that I could be a good writer. I didn't know if I could ever be great, but I knew that with Jesse I had written a great song. And I'm not saying that, I say that in all humility because it's so long ago now. I wrote it when I was 20 or 21. Mm. So it's very much apart from me. But it's a great song. And until you've written one of those, you really don't know if you have it in you.
And who was Jesse? I mean, was there a real, was there a Jesse?
Jesse started out when I was 14 to be about a Vietnam vet, and it just morphed into something more universal.
You, of course, wrote that song at 17. You were not 17 at the time. You were in your early 20s.
I was.
But I have to say, and we've listened to it several times over the last couple of days in preparation for the interview, and it holds up. And I think it holds up because you write about, in the most poignant kind of way, that adolescent angst.
Well, I think that the goal of any songwriter, certainly, is to hit that universal. I mean, you pray to write a song like at 17 that cuts through all those boundaries we put up, and cuts through gender, cuts through race, cuts through culture and language, and just goes to the heart.
Yeah. And I know that you were actually in the sort of genesis of the song. You were sitting at a table, I think your mother's table.
I was.
And you were looking at the
New York Times Magazine section, and there was a woman who wrote that she had thought that everything would be solved when she became a debutante at 18, and she said it wasn't. But the opening line, I think, was, I learned the truth at 18, and I was playing this ding-ding-ding-ding figure on the guitar, and 18 didn't scan, so it turned into 17. Mm.
And I learned the truth at 17 that love was meant for beauty queens.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those are powerful words.
That was a hard song to write. It really scared me every time I wrote it. But if there's anything that I do better than most of my contemporaries, and there's not very much, the one thing, perhaps, is that I can follow a painful trail. And I know that when something is scary to write, that's where I need to go.
There was this line in here, and I just think that a lot of adolescents feel this way. The world was younger than today when dreams were all they gave for free to ugly duckling girls like me. I mean, that's a powerful line. And I think a lot of girls in high school, probably boys as well, think they're ugly ducklings, even if they aren't.
I know. I watched the first Saturday Night Live that I was on, and I watched that for the first time about 4 weeks ago. And I looked at my partner, Pat, and I said, why did I think I was so awful looking? I'm not that awful looking. And she looked at me and went, well, duh. But I thought, I don't know anybody who likes looking in the mirror. I don't know a single person who stands there and admires themselves. Maybe once in a while you look and you think, oh, my makeup's good, and maybe I can spackle it on permanently. You know. But in general, none of us are happy with the way we look. And it's absurd, because what does it matter?
I learned the truth at 17. Their love was meant for beauty queens and high school girls with clear skin smiles who married young and then retired.
That was my conversation with singer-songwriter Janice Ian, who joined us on Radio Times 7 years ago. This song at 17 became a number one hit 40 years ago. She'll be appearing on the HBO series Getting On as the show wraps up its run next month. And that does it for this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, who edits the show with the help of our intern, Diana Allen. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Desperately remained at home, inventing lovers on the phone, who called to say, come dance with me, the murmured vague obscenities. It isn't all it seems. It's 17. A brown-eyed girl in hand-me-downs, whose name I never could pronounce, said, pity please the ones who serve. They only get what they deserve. Rich relation'd hometown queen marries into what she needs with a guarantee of company and haven for the elderly. Remember